we went through in Daf Yomi,
in the cycle of learning the daily Daf, and I went through it so quickly as that kind of Talmud learning lends itself to, that I thought good to go back to some part of Shabbat. Number two, this first Mishnah in this chapter deals with something we are all experientially familiar with, and that is reading of the sacred scrolls or the sacred scroll of the Torah, and brings us back into the cultural history, religious cultural history of our people in regards to the Torah itself and the holiness of the writings of the Tanakh. So at the same time that we are looking at the Torah Shebaal Peh, the Oral Torah, we're also going to be relating in this first mission at least to the Tanakh itself and see some attitudes about the Tanakh and also understand a little bit of the fluidity of the Tanakh, which I'll unpack down the line as we talk about what Tanakh and issues that arise around scrolls of Torah and scrolls of the Tanakh and translations of the Tanakh are all about. The third reason I chose it is because the notion of putting holy texts in a Geniza will be central to the topic of our Lucy Davidovich lecture already on the schedule this year, where we will hear from scholars who have looked into what it meant to us to have a Geniza in Cairo, what texts were located there, the whole notion of being lignos farim, of hiding away texts that are considered holy, have sanctity in our tradition. This is a topic of deep interest to me and to the Jewish people for our history. And we were able to see inside of the reality of the Jewish people of Alexandria and the diaspora Jewish communities through encountering that Geniza. So this first Mishnah mentions that central principle to what we do with holy texts. It mentions Geniza. So those are some of the reasons why this chapter interests me so. And the chapter doesn't stop there. The chapter is going to go on mishnaically to deal with topics that jump a little bit one place to the other within the context of sanctity and what we do with something that is either in use, not in use any longer. I think it's good for us to relate to in general on the whole, but we're going to look particularly at Mishnah Aleph in the chapter tonight. We're going to talk about the content of the first page of Gemara in this chapter, and in the investigation of the first Mishnah and the content of the first daf of Gemara in the chapter, we're going to plunge into some of the scholarship and some of what's known about the world of Targum, translation, and about why the rabbis might have been guarded in their allowing for translation, and or why attitudes about translation that we're going to see in the Gemara come up at all within the Mishnah and Gemara itself. So let's dive into the Mishnah. Mishnah Aleph is here in the Schottenstein edition, which is the art scroll edition, the fourth volume of the Talmud Bavli, the Schottenstein. It's on page 115A4. I'm sorry. 115A2. If you're in another type of Gemara, we're on Daf Kuf Tet Vav, page 115, Tzad Aleph, Amud Aleph. So, I'm going to read the Mishnah aloud, and we'll translate as we have been going forward. I'd like to get through the whole Mishnah and talk about it, and then go on to the Gemara after we have explored it more. Kol Kitvei Kodesh. All holy scriptures. Kol Kitvei Kodesh Matzilin Otan Mipnei Adleka. They may be saved from a fire. Now, if you, again, have Art Scroll as a translation in front of you, you see that it fills in idiomatically, whether they are Torah scrolls or scrolls of the other books of the Bible. But we have to remember, you really don't know that yet, if you're just reading straightforwardly the words of Mishnah without translation entirely. But Rashi says, "Kagon Torah Nevi'im Ketuvim Velo Tema Torah Lechud." In other words, we're talking about the books of the prophets, the books of the writings, right? So think about our Tanakh for a second. The Tanakh is made of three sections, right? The Torah itself, the five books of Moses, the prophets, those books that are center, if you will, in the bound edition and in the writings. Bein shekorin behen, whether you read from them, uvein she'en korin behem, or whether you do not read from them. So in order to understand this, shekorin, ben shekorin behen, Rashi says, kagon nevi'im shemachtirin behen b'shabbat b'beit ha-knesset. That whether you read from them means like those books of the prophets from which we read haftarot in the synagogue, v'she'ein korin behen kagon ketuvim, like with the writings that we do not read from. Now, it's going to go further. Af al pi sheketuvim b'chol lashon, and even though they are written in any language, meaning other than Hebrew, t'unin geniza, they are in need of being hidden away. They warrant being hidden away. Umipnei ma'ein korin behem, and why do we not read from them? Mipnei vitul beit hamidrash, because of the neglect of the beit hamidrash, because of the neglect of study, or what we call beit hamidrash. Now, again, learning Mishnah in and of itself is the first job before we learn the entire Gemara. The Gemara is many times relating directly back to the Mishnah. The Gemara many times takes off from the Mishnah or relates to some of the sages and moves from there, we know. But let's look closely. We translated it one way based on the idiomatic read of Art Scroll's translation. I just want to go through it one more time with the Art Scroll, and then we're going to move to the handout I gave you. Kol Kitvei HaKodesh Matzilin Otan Mipnei Hadleka. All holy scriptures, whether they are Torah scrolls or scrolls from the other books of the Bible. Now, what's interesting about the Mishnah in and of itself, right from the start, is that I have a qualifying word. I don't just have a subject defined by the Mishnah. Kitvei HaKodesh Matzilin Otan Mi'adleka. I have the word kol. The Rishonim themselves about the Mishnah say that the inclusion of the word kol is an indicator that there is obviously more to Kitvei Kodesh than what you thought Kitvei Kodesh were. If I didn't have some type of limud or learning to make out of such a premise as to what I can save or can't save from a fire, I would have known already that Torah I should take out of the fire. But of these other books that I might have around, I need to know whether or not I can save them. I at least have other scrolls. I could say, okay, in our Beit HaKnesset, in our synagogue, we have the Tanakh. oh, so now even with the prophets and the writings, I might be able to save them. I have the word kol. But then I might even have some other writings around. I might have writings that are both in Hebrew and potentially not in Hebrew. And I have to understand whether or not I can save all of them. The Rishonim, some of the Rishonim, are focused on this word kol, as to why the Mishnah moves through the track of learning, the track of teaching that it does. Because if I was not asking the question, what do I do with other than the Torah that I know is so sacred to our act of reading within our synagogue culture, I would never have put the word kol in the Mishnah, or the Mishnah would never have presented the word kol. So then we have the whole notion of deleika, a fire. Stop for a moment to say, what are they really worried about? Are they worried about the fact that we're just going to let something burn and that would be simply bizayon, it would be disgraceful were we not to really try to stop and save the writings in our synagogue? Or are we worried about some other type of problem when it comes to saving the writings themselves? As if the Leica was the most severe example of something that could happen, that everybody would think because of a fire, like you're saving yourself, and we say our scripture is so holy as to be life. We compare Torah to water, water to life. Thusly, we know that Torah is so deeply part of who we are, what we are. So like we save ourselves and flee the burning building, not worrying about where we land in the outside world of the public domain on the Sabbath, maybe it's okay with the fire burning and our need to save ourselves, perhaps it's all right. Is it okay, halachically, the question's being asked, to save a Torah scroll and bring it into the public zone, the public domain? Because I know I have a prohibition about something. What's the prohibition on Shabbat? One of the essential ones from Torah is carrying. So the fire might be one example of an instance that I have to make a quick decision about what I do in terms of carrying out into the public domain that which I seek to save. Of course, it says that we save them. Matzilin otan. Bein shekorin behen, uvein she'ein korin behen. Well, are we talking about reading from them only publicly in synagogue? Or are we talking about reading them at all? Rashi said, based on the culture that he knows about the Beit Knesset, based on the oral tradition that was passed along all the way back from the time of the Mishnah, perhaps, that it was about saving scrolls that were read publicly versus those that were not read publicly. But we know from other discussions in other places in the Gemara that there's also a discussion about whether or not a text in translation may be A, written at all, and if it's not allowable, whether it can be studied at all, should one be extant. Because you know how that works sometimes in our tradition. We have a law that says it shall not be done, yet we find one in amidst the other scrolls that are sitting there, because we still have this notion of, well, maybe the words are a little bit holy, and we say, oh, well, by the way, we keep it there, we keep it around, we don't exactly know what to do with it, but we don't read from it. Just like sometimes a pasul, something that's not kosher, a pasul scroll might be kept around, though it is not read from, or unlike that a little bit, in terms of the tension of what is allowable, what is not, by way of writing them. But once something's written, again, and it is pasul, what do we do with it? So, if we were not reading the idiomatic translation of the art scroll, there are other potential angles of questions that come to us. Sometimes they only come because we know the Gemara later. And sometimes we can find ourselves learning a Mishnah and trying to understand a Mishnah that presents a certain what-if scenario that's not exactly the only one that's dealt with later in our Gemara. That's Mishnah study in and of itself, which is why the Mishnah is written with commentaries in and of itself. The most famous being the Bar Menorah, others explicated by modern scholars. We have to ask the question about the Mishnah itself sometimes before you get into the Gemara study in order to move into the thinking of the rabbis. Oh, were they dealing with this kind of issue or were they not? In order to understand Gemara a little bit more clearly according to some way of thinking about the way we study Talmud. Now, the follow-up to even they may be written that way or they may or we don't write read the, from them, written or read from, versus not written and read from. Af al pi sheketuvim b'chol lashon, and even though they are written in any other language other than Hebrew, which is where I'm getting to the issue of the targum, the translation. Now, does that start a whole new phrase in the Mishnah? In other words, do I read the Mishnah, all holy scriptures may be saved from the fire, whether you read from them or not, period. And even though they're written in any language other than Hebrew, Tunin Geniza, they're in need of Geniza. Or does that af statement, af al pi sheketuvim b'chol lashon, even though they're written in any language, relate directly back to the first part, which is, you either save them or you don't, depending on whether you read from them or not. What kind of other language text might I read from that I'm going to have a question about saving? That one phrase in the Mishnah either tends to go up with the first part, again, repeating, up with the first part, or more with the notion of Geniza. And then what do I learn about any of these texts if it really is Af al pi sheketuvim b'chol lashon tunin Geniza? Well, the most basic answer is even though I don't read from them, and it's not just talking about what I don't read from on a Sabbath in terms of a public reading of Torah, Haftarah, and other types of liturgical, worship-oriented readings, I might have a translation of a text that I know now from this Mishnah needs Geniza. And that's an interesting premise if I know a little bit about what's going on in rabbinic culture at the time of the Mishnah and what kind of texts we might have in our Beit Knesset, in our synagogue that exists either in the land of Israel, the ancient land of Israel, or in Alexandria, Egypt, or in some kind of faraway Greek locale where maybe there were some Jews who wanted something in Greek. Alexandrian Jews were those Greek-speaking Jews whom the Gemara presents as Jews who were invoked, asked to create, or at least demanded or created the need for a Greek translation. And then there are stories told about how he actually got to it, a Greek translation of the Torah. So this Mishnah, which ends with Mivnei Ma Ein Korin Behem, Mivnei Bitul Beit HaMidrash, and why do we not read from them at all? Because of the neglect of the Beit Midrash. Presents the texts really in light of the liturgical worship experience on Shabbat in a kind of for sure way, because that relates to a practice. What's called Beit Midrash here is the practice that was defined by the rabbis as listening to lectures in matters of law and ethics on the Sabbath afternoon. There was a practice, as the footnote says a little bit, and others have noted in various places in scholarship, that on Sabbath afternoon, people would gather back in the synagogue, and in the way of teaching in oral fashion, remember things are not really written down during this time, and books don't have the same status, per se, as the giving over of oral lessons time and again in order to teach people the ultimate truth of the matter. If one were to sit with a scroll and try to get through the lessons that were in some type of scripture, it would be neglecting the type of interpretive and legal discourse that were considered to be the most important and central act of Jewish communal gatherings on the Sabbath. And thusly, we do not allow for such reading at times, either during the worship service, it seems, with some of them, and for sure not during the day. Because if we were allowing the kind of reading in translations and or originals, if you were of those who knew the original language, but translations so accessible in the vernacular, idiomatic sometimes, I'll come back to that, and I'm able to see into this and read myself, I don't need the culture of the lesson on a Sabbath afternoon and the explication or the interpretation or the legal analysis that is derived from a relationship back to Torah and the use of verses to teach such lessons. All packed into this first Mishnah. Such a culturally rich Mishnah by way of some of the things that we feel are so central to us. First of all, it deals with our textuality. You know, we like to think of ourselves as people of the book. That phrase is coined a little bit later on in history. Some who even think it wasn't even a Jewish phrase to begin with. That we were called Am HaSefer in somewhat of a challenging way, because we were so bookish and went back to the verse in its simplest sense this way and derived the legal and had hermeneutical textuality within the discourse of creating the kind of rules for our lives, and so we were the Am HaSefer. Of course, we've taken it to mean that we just love our books, and at Shavuot HaSefer, the week of the book in Israel, some of the best sales on everything from Kitbei Kodesh to holy books to secular novels happens, and this is the culture that we want to progress. The notion, though, that we have some books that are permissible, and then some action, some activity of translation that would be erroneous, religiously unacceptable, not a good idea for the cohesiveness of the people as the rabbis are trying to create a culture that has a certain rule, a canon. It all relates back to canonical discussions as much as it relates to individual Jewish community understandings at a time. This is coming out in this Mishnah here. And of course, Sabbath observance and how we actually observe the Sabbath being noted in such a way as to reflect the cultural reality and what we would give up should we let everybody just go and sit in Central Park and read a novel. If we don't come back for the reading of the public scroll, we don't come back to hear the interpretations thereof by the rabbis in this Beit Midrash type of setup, if we don't come back and read the scroll again at Mincha on Shabbat, and keep the culture alive in such a way, then we have each person in his or her own reading translations, let alone the real text. And what kind of cultural reality are we going to progress if we don't really create a gold standard of Torah and these books of the Bible? This sense that the rabbis have, that they also want to keep very much to understanding what is and what is not permissible to carry on the Sabbath, did create indeed a certain type of practicing community within Jewish circles who cared so deeply about the notion of not carrying within Rashut HaRabim, within the public domain, versus private, that definitively it allowed for us to create a certain working within the holy rules of halakha, the Dalet Amot Shel Halakha, the four pillars of halakha, in order to figure out everything from carrying or not carrying a Torah into the area in which you might be safe from this fire, and of course asking the value question, what's more important, the Torah scroll and to run back for it, or saving yourself? But I don't really believe that that's the question, the fundamental question here. That's kind of a literary gloss or ethical gloss that one might make on the Mishnah in a way that not a sage, in my review at least of those I read, asked the question. So the notion that we have a serious question about whether we can carry something into this alleyway, very important question. Now, I gave you a packet of material that I'm going to refer to time and again throughout our study of the first Mishnah. The translation in front of you here of this Mishnah is from the Judaica Press version of the Mishnah. Listen to the way it's translated without a lot of idiomatic inclusions. All holy scriptures may be saved from fire, whether they read from them or not. And in whatever language they may be written, they require to be hidden away. And what is the reason why they may not read them? Lest the sermon teaching be rendered of no effect. So, you see, and then in that version, the Mishnah goes on. And in our version, we have Gemara already on that section. Now, there are different manuscripts of the Mishnah that are extant. And so that's why you have differentiated versions. You have the Munich, you have the Leningrad, the Center for Manuscripts at the Hebrew University, you can find them all online, see them pretty much in the original. There's a Vatican manuscript, I understand. I don't believe we've gotten access for a while. So there's manuscript work to be done on the Mishnah. Anyhow, I bring you that because it says the sermon. So this notion that early on in the Beit Knesset that there was homiletical work going on is tucked into the translation there in Judaica Press, and that it wasn't just hermeneutical Talmudic discourse, but that it somehow was of homiletic nature, say ethical nature, is a debate among scholars as to what the content of that afternoon Beit Midrash on Shabbat was really all about. Why is there a debate? There's a debate because people who would come on Shabbat afternoon oftentimes worked and were not of the class of the Chachamim. They were not of the class of sages who might understand the kind of parlance entirely. And even though there could have been the process of teaching people the kind of frameworks of learning that we're familiar with over time because of the systemic approach that has been presented to us by the editors of the Gemara, thank God, it was that discussion about what the nature of these discussions on Shabbat afternoon was all about came to be, and there the translation that we're offered of this Mishnah really has, in and of itself, a presentation of an idea about what it was that Beit Midrash represents in this case. The Hebrew phrase Beit Midrash being part of the Hebrew. This last phrase, Umipnei Ma'in Korim Behen, Mipnei Bitul Beit HaMidrash. And why do we not read from them? Because of the neglect of the Beit HaMidrash. We'll get to some of the Gemara, and then we'll go back to some of the packet. Gemara. Let's launch in. The Gemara cites a dispute regarding foreign language translations. Itamar, it was stated, Hayu Ketuvim Targum O B'chol Lashon, if they, the scrolls of scriptures, were written in Aramaic or in any other language besides Hebrew. So how do I know that from the statement Vahayu Kituvim Targum O V'chol Lashon? Do I see the word Aramaic anywhere? Aramit? No, I don't hear the word Aramit. I have the word Targum. By this time, Targum to me, if I am a listening ear of the sages and I'm hearing Torah Shebaal Peh, Targum is the word for Aramaic. Targum has become, in essence, my understanding of Targum is that which we practice in our synagogues from before the Second Temple is destroyed. It's also the Aramaic translations of two, what we now have as very famous translations into Aramaic that exist beside Torah and the Prophets. One is the translation of Onklos. That's for Torah. And one is the translation of Yonatan ben Uziel. And that is the one for the Prophets. And so in a Mikraot Gedolot for Prophets, you would have, like you do with Mikra Gedolot for Torah, with Rashi and Ramban and others, even Ezra for Torah, you would have, a Nevi'im has Rashi and Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, and Targum of Yonatan ben Uziel. I know this word Targum means Aramaic because there's in the Gemara already, before I have the written texts in Aramaic of Onklos and Yonatan, there's the practice of actually saying the Torah as it's read aloud in Hebrew in Aramaic. And I know this from the Gemara in Megillah, where with Torah reading, each verse would be read and said in Aramaic by a second person who was the Mitargaman, who was the translator. Each verse. Versus the Haftarah selection, where three verses were read, and then an Aramaic translation was offered. This practice was considered standard, and thus written about by Professor Lee Levine, in his tome on the ancient synagogue. And if you want a great read about the ancient synagogue culture, this is the place. It's a fantastic, fantastic book. And he says, it's impossible to assess when the first Aramaic translations made their appearance, although we have scholars who suggest very early dates in the Second Temple period. The difficulty is that all extant manuscripts of the Targumim, Onklos, Targum Yonatan of the Prophets, Targum Pseudo-Yonatan, another of the Prophets, Neofiti, other fragments, derived from any time between the 7th and 16th centuries. We don't have anything older. Moreover, there is evidence of late interpolation, such as the off-quoted reference to Muhammad's wife and daughter in Targum Pseudo-Yonatan of Genesis, in Genesis 21, for instance. The mention of Constantinople within them. Reference to the six orders of Mishnah, already coined, not back at the time of the original Torah. Given the presence of clearly late material, why should we assume the antiquity of the Targum genre at all? Well, we have evidence of written Targumim from the pre-70 period. Fragments of an Aramaic Targum of Leviticus and Job have been found at Qumran. And rabbinic literature as well makes reference to a Targum of Job found in the time of Rabban Gamliel II at the turn of the 2nd century. This last source also cites an earlier tradition that a fragment of the Targum of Job was found during repair or reconstruction work on the Temple Mount in the days of Rabban Gamliel the Elder. So the Targum as an integral part of the synagogue liturgy is well known from later antiquity. Detailed laws relating to this practice, as well as accounts of people who function in the capacity of delivering the Targum, along with the translations and interpretations on such occasions, abound in rabbinic sources. And he cites, several places, Megillah, as I mentioned. Even second century authorities were already well aware of this practice and discussed many regulations associated therewith. These Tanaitic sages were not initiating a new practice, but rather were commenting upon, critiquing, and shaping an already existing institution. Thus, it is quite likely that the practice goes back to at least to the late Second Temple period. Moreover, the reference in Targum Yonatan to the Hasmonean ruler John Hyrcanus is often cited as proof of the existence of the early material. He was a leader during Maccabean times. So, we have this notion of Targum Baal Peh, of translation out loud. And whether or not, A, it was permitted to be written down and read from, was at the heart of some of the discussions and the matter when it came to the Torah. No one wanted it to seem as though we were reading Holy Scripture, and therefore the oral tradition of the Targumon, of the translator, was to stand aside and not even have a scroll from which to read. So we have this question: Hayu Ketuvim Targum Ovechol Lashon? If they, the scrolls of scriptures, were written in Aramaic or in any other language besides Hebrew, Rav Huna Amar. Rav Huna says, Ein Matilino Tan Mipnei Adaleka. You can't save them from a fire on the Sabbath, says Rav Huna. If the scrolls are written in Aramaic or in any other language. I have a tradition that Rav Huna says, Ein matzilino tami pnei hadaleka. You can't save them. Well, the Mishnah, right. So the Mishnah said what? Kol kipei kodesh, all of the Holy Scriptures, you do save. Bein shekorin behen, whether you read from them, uvein she'ein korin behen, whether you don't read from them, even though they were written in any language other than Hebrew, tunin geniza, they need geniza. If that second phrase or the second part of even though they're written in any language goes with I need geniza, then what's the first part of the Mishnah say? The first part of the Mishnah says all Holy Scriptures may be saved from a fire whether I read from them or not. Period. Possibility number one, period. Then I have the second part which says, and even though they're written in any language, I need geniza. Possibility number two, all Holy Scriptures may be saved from a fire whether or not I read from them or not, and in any language, period. Right? Tunin geniza. Everything needs geniza. All these writings. So there is some discussion about that later on. But meanwhile, I do start by saying, if they were written in Aramaic or in any other language besides Hebrew, Rav Huna holds what? Ein matzilinotan. Whereas Rav Chista says, matzilinotan mipnei adaleka. You do save them because of the fire. So it sounds like our Mishnah is going with who? Rav Chista. So let's put these two out now as what the Gemara's project is going to be for a minute. To tell us about this machloket, right? Remember what a machloket is? A machloket in the Gemara is an argument between two sages. Part of what we're trying to discover is, what are they really arguing about? What's the question they have? And sometimes it might seem that I understand the question they're really arguing about, but do I really understand the question they're arguing about? So far, it seems pretty straightforward. That they just have a disagreement about whether or not you save holy writings, right? Who says you save them? Who says you don't save them? Okay. Rav Huna and Rav Chista.
What is need, when you say need, Geniza, what are the criteria for the Geniza? What does that mean? Does it mean that it has the name of God on the document?
We didn't hear that. It just says they need Geniza. I'm going to leave that open, or on purpose, because that's all the Mishnah said so far. It seems like anything that was written as a holy text needs Geniza. Whether you read from it or you don't. Thus indicating to me from the parlance of the Gemara, whether it's in Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic, or potentially other languages. Even. Though those are less common. So, that's really what the Mishnah is saying. It seems to be saying they all need Geniza. They need to be hidden away. Doesn't say a thing about the name of God.
Okay. How about this reading of this Mishnah? There's another way to read the Mishnah.
Okay.
So all holy writings, we could discuss later what that means, Matsilin al Tamit Neh. So if it's a holy writing, you say you can. Vein shekarin v'hen or vein she'ein karin v'hen, whether you read from it or not, even if afal pi shekatuv shektuvim v'chol lashon, so whether you read or you don't read, even if it's written in a foreign language, in a different language, to nim geniza. So whatever it is that you need a geniza, which presumably we'll find out, it's going to apply to whether you read it or you don't read it. And whether it's in Hebrew or in some other language.
Right.
So that's the second issue. And then why don't we read from these things? And because that's like a third thing. That's like a little anecdote. Why is it that there are some things that we don't read? Because we want them to come in and learn the good things and the bad things and not have to read from Ksuvu, which I guess is... So then you have an ability for the two rabbis to argue about, well, what is it that we're saving and what are we, what does it mean, Kitvei HaKodesh? One says if it's in Hebrew, you can save, and the other one says you can't save.
Good. So to simplify, what they might be arguing about is the Kitvei HaKodesh issue. If we just take that first statement as, all the holy writings, you save them. So the question becomes, what are holy writings? Right? Whether they're written in Hebrew or whether they're not written in Hebrew, I need Geniza. That's how you're reading?
Yeah, it's just a different subject. It doesn't relate to saving them. Presumably, if things that go into a Geniza, they're damaged. So I'm going to guess that what somebody will end up saying is, at least in the way I'm reading it, this is like a separate subject.
Yeah.
Like somebody could ask, well, what goes into a Geniza? If it's holy text, but it's written in Aramaic, does it go into a Geniza?
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. And then the Beit HaMidrash issue is a third. Good.
Introducing fire as the form of harm and the only form of harm that were introduced. Is this a reflection of their reality that they already felt imperiled by powers, political powers, who used fire as a tool to harm the Jewish community? They could have used water. They could have used shoddy construction. So, fire.
Yeah.
Isn't simply coincidentally arbitrary, nor is it without reason a cause. So are they also asking us to think of, in essence, arson? And this is now a political argument. And then the multiple languages would have deeper meaning if we would start off with the premise that the harm comes from a political goal. And obviously we all can go to Kristallnacht as our illustration of what we can see photos of.
I know some anti-colonialists who would read any chance they get, any part of the Mishnah and any part of rabbinic literature, as being against the colonizers and choosing the example of how one ultimately was destroyed in the Beit HaMikdash seems to have some of that literary resonance that you might be suggesting. Nonetheless, I don't know that it's such a political commentary. But again, these things are quite open in today's literary reading of Talmud scholarship that's going on now. It's an interesting question to ask. What's the symbol of the Deleika, of the fire that breaks out within the structure of Masechet Shabbat, particularly because it's, you know, an older kind of Gemara. It's established. Henry?
When they say, when we're talking about reading from it, or not reading from it, we, like, set, like, the Torah, which is in the Ark, which is without bells, which is without mistakes, that's, like, the highest level of holiness, and then, you know, something written in, well, something with vowels is something, already it's an interpretation, it's got a lower level of holiness, and then something in another language, lower still, but they're saying, you know, you're going down these levels, and even that, you, for a particular purpose, you have to save it. And the Geniza is like something else. One is saving from fire, which is one element of sort of destruction. The other Geniza is like a different treatment of the holy book. So is that, am I on the right track? Or?
Well, the second track, I think you have two tracks there,
right.
If I may. I do think that the track from not letting something to be destroyed in fire and burned, like the scroll might have been burned around Rabbi Akiva. Now you got us thinking about where the fires of burning Torahs happen, or just simply not letting a Torah burn because fire is a simple danger and we know that we ought to do something about it. I think the difference between the fire and allowing it to burn versus caring for it uniquely with Geniza, there's probably different ways to treat things. Of course, burning the thorns in a field that do not allow you to plant, proactively burning scrolls that you think might be worn out and non-readable, is at the opposite end of this Mishnah. We save them from the fire, and we save them from the fire by burying them. So yes, there is an element of this. By the Geniza, we don't burn them when they're done. We don't simply throw them away and then turn them to ash. By the way, a recurring theme when we talk about the holiness of burying someone in the earth, right? That we neither burn our old Torah scrolls, nor do we, you know, cremate and you know, burial of people. Our sacred texts are buried, and our sacred bodies are buried. So, that on that issue. The other piece that you're referring to, levels of holiness and vowels. So, Torah scrolls themselves didn't have vowels, per se. The Masoretes start that tradition. They start getting people who have written Bibles to include some vowels and symbols doesn't necessarily necessitate the same kind of closing them in an Arona Kodesh. So there are certain things from the ancient world that we know that should be enclosed in your Arona Kodesh, and certain things that do not need an Arona Kodesh per se, or a special cabinetry within the Beit Knesset, or even in your home. Like when you have a Torah, we're supposed to still have an ark and not just keep it sitting on a chair or on a table or what have you. So a Bible never had that. And so there is a level of Kedusha with a Bible, a scroll written for study, or a Bible in a codex form, fast forward a book, that's very different than a Torah. And yes, there is a certain level of holy disparity between Torah, prophets, and writings that is being discussed within the parlance of this Mishnah.
Yeah,
interested in the general issue of the anthropomorphizing of the Torah, treating the Torah as a person, equivalent. Everyone's going to get to the Geniza and burials as one demonstration of it. But I think it also comes out in the willingness to say the Torah as if it were a person. So we wouldn't talk about, you know, carrying a person out of a fire, although we might. We'd escort them out because that's the equivalent. And even the way we respond to the Torah when it travels around the synagogue, keep looking at it. And you said it has to have its own Aron HaKodesh, it's got to have its own house because it has to have a fitting place for it to reside. And even when we take off the cover, we treat it as if it's now uncovered, and we wait out of respect for it to get covered before we sit down. So there's many, many different ways in which we incorporate anthropomorphizing the Torah, and I can understand it. Frankly, it makes me sometimes a little uneasy because it isn't a human, but on the other hand, it's sacred. And so the difference between what's appropriate for sacredness but non-human sacredness versus what's appropriate for human, I think is an interesting line and theme.
And where we stop, and some but few and an absolute minority, where we stop is at counting the Torah and the Minyan. And what's interesting about the discomfort that you describe is that those who wind up counting the Torah and the Minyan somehow anthropomorphize all the way to adding this true human element and quality to the Torah, where I would say that Rove Poskim, it's not all, I once looked at the issue a little bit, there's more text to look at about it, of course, but it's very difficult to count a Torah as a human being, though we bury it, though when it's undressed we cover it. So I think that tension exists deeply within the practice of what we do with Torah, as you say. What's further fascinating in terms of the anthropomorphism issue is that the Targumim in the Aramaic, this is just a happen to be connected kind of thing like the Gemara will sometimes do, but we're in the middle of talking about Targumim, translations. Aramaic Targumim, influenced deeply by Greek thought according to the work of Azriel Eisenberg in his book, The Book of Books, explains why, and this thusly explains in a little bit about rabbinic culture and their fear of translation, explains why the Targumim upend the the anthropomorphic look at God and what God does for the Jewish people. So Targumim will replace God walking in front of somebody with a verb like God leading. It'll replace words like the open hand.
You mean the translations bring it down?
The translations change it.
And they bring it up?
Entirely. There's not a mention of God as, if you will, with human limb.
So what do they say instead of human hand?
I think I included a part of this for you because it's so fascinating a part. Come on. Yeah. Take a look on page 8 of the packet.
Okay.
I numbered myself in circles. Page 8. Onkelos is quite faithful to the original. He sometimes clarifies the text so as to give it a meaning more relevant to the times and to educate the people. As a result of the Greek influence, both Targums interpret the text as so as to remove any statement about God which gives him the semblance of a man, such as that God walked, saw, spoke, or smelled. In Targum Onkelos, God does not walk, but he leads. He does not smell, but he accepts sacrifices. He does not pass over the doors of the children of Israel, but he spares them. And so on. Wherever the biblical narrative contains acts regarded as unbecoming to God, an angel is substituted. So on several fronts, the Targumim do that job and have, they're disquieted too by such anthropomorphizing as of not only Torah potentially, but of God, and so the tension exists in that world, in that theater, between making human and not. So, Ron?
In regards to our question about the Dleka, they could use three words, Esh, Srefa, or Dleka. Dleka comes from the root of Delek, means that it was being fueled. Means that in those synagogues, they used to have fire on Shabbat for heating or light. Uh-huh. And what happened, the fire overcome the boundaries. So that's the Dleka. That's what I think. So this is being propelled by the materials in the synagogue.
Interesting.
Let me just make it clear. So in other words, the use of this fire word refers to a kind of fire
that can be fueled, that there is fuel to fuel it.
So they would do it like before Shabbat to do the whole
thing? Yeah, they put the fire before Shabbat and it was through the whole weekend.
Right.
And it just overcome the boundaries.
So this is like a
and there was fuel to continue propel the
fire. Yeah. Interesting take philologically on what is it? It's not necessarily in any of the Targumim.
Right.
Yeah, but it's an interesting take on the philosophy.
I'm sure they had some lighting or some that was candles or was it possible?
Yeah. I mean, there's oil lamps that are lit.
So it shouldn't be a first part of
damaging.
It could be within the own.
But this is
right.
Very important addition.
Now, in regards to the Targum, my question is, what is the period that the Targum was in existence? In years, 100 years, 200 years, and why we don't do it today as Minagavotenu Minagenu?
Yeah, well,
Yemenite steward in Jerusalem.
Right, I was gonna offer. Yeah. We have certain cultures that have continued it straight through.
What language do they use?
So what they read it in Hebrew.
Yemenite.
They take it to Yemenite.
They're speaking in Yemenite. They have a Targum in Yemenite. So I said, if you want to go to the experience of listening to a Targum, you go down Rehov Yehudit, which is just across from Machane Yehuda, from the Shuk, a little beyond the police station. You go back to one of the central Yemenite shuls, and you go early enough, because it takes a long time, though. So, and you can hear it today, that someone knows it also orally. They don't have to read it. So they'll read the whole parsha with translation. We think, like Professor Levine said, that already 3rd century BCE this tradition began? Maybe a little bit earlier, maybe a little bit later. The Gemara, both the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, and the Babylonian record the tradition. So we know that it was Min HaGavotenu Bidenu at that point. Throughout the Middle Ages, there are very few communities that translated into Romance languages. It's considered to be inappropriate.
So maybe because of the language? It
still goes on. Here's how it goes on. There's a mitzvah to read the Torah twice in Hebrew and once in translation every week. So if you're serious about your Torah study, you can have a specialized book that actually has 3 verses written one after the other.
Hebrew, Hebrew, Aramaic.
And it's in, 17 volumes, so that you can do your twice in Hebrew, once in Targum.
All at the same time?
So you read the first Aliyah twice Hebrew, one Aramaic, twice Hebrew, one Aramaic, every verse. There are some people who like that approach. There's also an approach in modernity of people gaining this practice back. So rabbis who are trained in the Reform movement are trained in their first and second years to read Torah, stop, translate every three verses, borrowing from the way we used to do Haftarah. Interesting. Makes for quite a relationship to the text that you had not a lot of relationship with before in a lot of cases. Parts that you'd never studied. There's also in that circle the tradition of reading a lot less, because there's no way to sit as a community and do that for even a third of the Torah reading, which was the Palestinian custom, or the whole reading as was the Babylonian custom.
May actually fit in with what Barry was saying.
Yeah.
That is, all holy scriptures may be saved. So, does that translate to must be saved? I mean, you're allowed to do it, but what is our responsibility to do it once you're allowed to do it?
Yeah, so may be means it's permitted, thusly you do it. It's very, very legal language for...
But if you don't risk your own life.
One does. Obviously, you shouldn't entirely risk your own life, but... Matilinotan. You save them. In other words, another way to translate this without the English...
You should, as long as you don't...
Save them.
Right. So, now, as opposed to a human being in a fire, we must, right? So, I'm making this distinction also with the Torah as not a person. So, you should, but not if you're going to risk your life.
And
if it were a person, it would be more imperative. Yes?
It depends who is the person.
depends who's the person. Let's put it this way. It depends what year you're asking the question. Are you sending us back to the days of the rabbis or the Rambam? Or are we asking that now? In other words... It's quite a debate in Judaism whether or not we pull a cave-in off of non-Jews.
Human life is not human life.
We are concerned... for the community. We are potentially concerned for what some might blame us for if we're to be involved in going to the rescue. You know, there were not necessarily Good Samaritan laws in all of the kingdoms where we were a people. So I think part of it is actually a legal discourse, not about humanity, but about how people would be treated under the law. Should we not save the person? But again, that's a discussion about legal sources that demand a look inside.
I would make it
yeah. So any time that we don't risk our lives unduly, we have an obligation to save life, and even to break Shabbat to do so. Pikuach nefesh dofei et haShabbat. Saving lives puts aside all laws of Sabbath. Do you mind? Can I?
One quick one, and that is the concept of the archival copy and the absolute threat that all translation poses to the archival copy, and realizing that. What comes through to me is the highest value is the protection of the archival copy. And if you speak to librarians today, they're going crazy because of the difficulty in the modern information age and what to do about this issue of the archival copy.
Right.
But I think that theme just jumps out.
Yes.
Right?
The rabbis are absolutely interested in the Or text, right? The Torah in of itself. And what will happen if we allow for translation and other texts to displace? I want to get back to that, hold that, because that is absolutely central to the discussion here. But I want to do a little bit more of the parlance of the machloket now, in the Gemara. So Rav Chisda and Rav Huna are arguing, and we're holding them up. Rav Huna again says, Ein Masilin Otan, you don't save them, and Rav Chisda says, you save them. The Gemara explains the disagreement. Ah, liba demanda amar nit nulik rod pahen, dechule alma lo plige de Masilin. According to the one, the Tana. What's the Tana? It's the rabbi of the Mishnaic age. According to the one who says that we may read from them, in other words, translations, no one argues that they may be saved. If they're permitted to be written, and if they're permitted to be read from, then they fall into the category, a la the way we ask the question, are they Kitvei Kodesh or not? Yeah, they're Kitvei Kodesh. They're holy, and thus we save them. So, the Gemara comes to explain the Machloket. What are they really arguing about? If you're telling me that the argument between Rabbi Huna and Rabbi Chisda falls into place within the discussion about this shita, this approach to law, I'm going to tell you, no, they're not arguing about that approach to holy books. Again, a different way. We had the argument between Rabbi Huna and Rabbi Chisda, right? Rabbi Huna says what?
No.
Ain matzilin. Rabbi Chisda says, you save them. According to the Tana, who says we can read from them and therefore write them and read them, do Rabbi Chisda and Rabbi Huna have any argument at all? Rabbi Huna and Rabbi Chisda don't have an argument if the halachic approach we have to books in translation is that they can be written and they can be read. They're not arguing according to that shita. In other words, remember, they can argue the law depending on what the law is. If the law is that I can write them and I can read them, Rabbi Huna and Rabbi Chisda, their machloket right now, their argument, doesn't apply here. Because everybody agrees, what? If they can be read, meaning they can be written, then they're holy and you save them. Gemara works hard. Or Gemara's legal language is to tell you what the argument is really all about and where it fits in, what it's really imagining the shita is. The word shita means the approach, halachically, that I take to the question at hand. What's the question at hand? Which do you save? Are they Kitvei Kodesh, or are they not? So when they argue about whether you save them or not, it really is an argument that concerns the shita. Ki plige ali b'demanda amar lo nitnu likro behen. When do they argue? When do they disagree? According to the shita, according to the legal outlook that says, we may not read from them. So that's where the conversation starts. You can't read them and you can't write them. But they're there. You understand? They're there. You're not allowed to write them, you're not allowed to read from them, or maybe it's just on Shabbat that you're not allowed to read from them. So you can write them. Maybe
if they're on Yom Chol.
Exactly. Maybe they can be around for the studying purposes during the week. Either which way, I'm not interested even in that question right now, whether I'm talking about solely Shabbat. I'm just talking about a shita that says, I can't write them, I can't read them. When I have the legal outlook that I can't write them, I can't read them, if they should exist, and a fire breaks out on Shabbat, and we're in the Beit Knesset, and we're all deciding, what are we saving from the Aron HaKodesh? Rabbi Huna and Rabbi Chisda have a different position. Rabbi Huna says, even though, or given that, right? Which one says what? Rabbi Huna says, given that I can't write them and I can't read them, ein matzilin otan, I don't save them. And Rabbi Chisda says, okay, you can't write them, you can't read them, they're there, save them. Everybody clear on what the machloket is now about? And the legal principle guiding the discussion?
Where are you seeing write them?
Right, so if you think about the word likrot ben, right, read them, I'm adding a dimension of write them, because I'm understanding that the discussion throughout the Gemara, including Masechet Megillah particularly, on 8b and 9a, which we'll look at, are really about whether or not I am permitted to write the texts in any language, and then thusly read the texts. So you're right. I'm adding that word. If you're reading it to see what am I translating? Okay, I'm letting that inform me. My translation. Rav Huna Amar Ein Matzilin. Rav Huna says Ein Matzilin. We can't save them. Daha lo nitnu likrot behen, since they can't be read. Rav Chista Amar Matzilin Mishum. What? But Rav Chista says you save them. Maybe not because they're Kitvei HaKodesh. Why do you save them? Mishum bizayon Kitvei HaKodesh. Because of the disgrace that will happen to the Holy Scriptures. Meaning what?
It's still the Torah. It's in a different language.
Okay, that's going the direction of...
Yes and no.
That's going but I'm just talking about the language that you use now and the relationship here and the easy for us to imagine that we're talking about the translation itself, the actual scroll itself, and the disgrace that will happen to the, you know, once removed original or text that is the holy nature of it. So if I have the English translation of the Tanakh by the Jewish Publication Society and it's sitting beside the Chumash with Hebrew, I take them both, because even though one's only English, boy, there's still bizayon to Divrei Kodesh, there's still disgrace to the holy language within them. Okay? Another way of looking at that phrase. Anybody else have a different idea? Mishum bizayon kivei kodesh. If I don't save those that are not allowable to be read... What?
Why would they be there if... They're not allowed to be written or read.
Okay, so again, one answer is that maybe on non-Shabbat I can read them. Another answer is that they do have this relationship to the original Torah, prophets, writings, and therefore they're over here. According to the position right now, our rabbi says we shouldn't read those. They're still around. I might even use those kosher skins or non-kosher skins to write something else later. And that's the place where I keep my, well, if we're talking about the Aron HaKodesh, you're right. Why? So it seems to be that there is some permissibility to actually have the text extant in writing, but I don't read them on Shabbat. I'm adding the dimension of writing again, because maybe something was preserved from back when. I wound up keeping the Greek translation that we had around. It's in my Aron HaKodesh, because it definitely was Torah that was translated, right? But these days, X number of years later, we don't read from them, and by the way, we also are not allowed to write. We're not allowed to write them. They have a relationship. So these are all the possibilities that I have with the actual scrolls themselves. So
being able to write them mean?
What's that?
What is not being able to write them?
That I can't, if I want to, for my local group here in Alexandria, write the Greek translation that we could all read a little easier, because we're Greek speakers. Or if I'm an Aramaic speaker living in Babel, Babylonia, or speak Palestinian Aramaic, I really can't write down my targum.
Is there an implication you're writing it for the purpose of, that's a proscribed purpose, or just you can't write it at all?
I shouldn't bring it to the Beit Knesset and read it and purport to be reading from a scroll, because really what's holy is on the scroll, and I should just say it out loud? Or, I shouldn't really make it even to study, because... And this is the part of the rabbinic culture that I'm going to get to more and more. inherently every translation is an interpretation. Inherently. And every translation already proves to be an interpretation and sometimes radically changes something. So we save them on account of the disgrace of the Holy Scriptures. Here's a radical reread of that little section. I preserved them so I know what exactly we are not supposed to do. I have a few archival texts that prove to me this is why we don't allow this. And I keep them around in my library so that I can become acutely aware of the danger of allowing for translation. Just like in the Talmud itself, we preserve the traditions of the erroneous translation project of the Septuagint. I want to unpack what I'm saying right now for the last part of class, because it's very, very essential. This is like such a moment of rabbinic culture come alive in this Mishnah and the discussion here. The Septuagint is perhaps at the heart of the discussion of translation. The Septuagint is what? It's the 70 scribes, 72 scribes, getting it translated into Greek at the request of King Ptolemy, where he sends word out according to the Gemara to Eleazar, Kohen Agadol, and he brings the elders and God gives them the gift of all exactly saying the exact same translation for every word of the Torah according to the way the Gemara preserves it. Yet, the Gemara preserves all of the differences in the ways that they had to translate it, some because maybe they didn't have the right words, others because they didn't want to offend Ptolemy. Well, it came out to be the project of Greek translation in the reign of Ptolemy. We're going to look further at the source, so we'll understand more of what I'm saying. The notion here is that we sometimes have to preserve these things in order not to disgrace the original Holy Scripture. We started with, perhaps we're saving them because they themselves had some level of Kedusha, they themselves had some level of holiness, because they were actual translations of Torah, but it could also be, given what we know about translations and what they were in this age, that we save them so that we have them, again, so we know what not to do to our sacred texts. What is not allowed in the theater of creating the sacred texts that Jews should use within their ritual worship, within their public reading of the law, within the public reading of the Haftarah. We don't want necessarily these texts, and we have to understand why. It's a reread. It's potential. It gets into some sources that we'll look at the next time, because I want to push a little bit further into the Gemara before the night ends, so that we have some further Gemara. The Gemara challenges Rav Huna. Ein matzilin otan, Rav Huna says. We don't save them. And we're in the shita, we're in the halachic approach, that we don't read in these, and that's when Rav Huna says we don't save them. If we can't read them, we don't save them. Tanan, we've learned in the Mishnah. Kol kitei HaKodesh matzilin otan mipnei hadaleika, all holy scriptures may be saved from a fire. Bein shekorin behem, bein she'en korin behem, whether we read from them or whether we do not read from them, even though they are written in any other language. My love, shekorin behen nivi'im v'she'en korin behem ketuvim. Now, is not the meaning of the mission as follows? That the ones we read from are the nivi'im scrolls, because that's where we make our haftarot, and the ones we don't read from are Ketuvim, are the writings, because we don't read anything from there. That section of the Tanakh. By the way, what would we say about that, knowing what we do in the synagogue? What's
in the liturgy. It's chock full of the Ketuvim are in the liturgy. A lot.
In the prayer?
In the Psalms and in the...
Right, so they're in the prayer rite, so we don't read from them? So you must be saying that actual performative reading is at stake here.
You don't read them like you read the Torah. That's quite different.
Exactly. That's the distinction. The distinction here is we don't take the scrolls out and read from them. At that point, remember, there's not Siddurim. There are no Siddurim.
Right.
So the recital of Psalms and the recital of verses from the writings is obviously differentiated here. The way this Braita presents it, we don't read from Ketuvim at all. What's the other issue? Not just that we say Ketuvim sometimes within liturgy and liturgical experience, but when do we actually use parts of Ketuvim? Parts of that part of the Bible? Right. During the holidays. And we know from Bava Metzia already that some recitations of the scrolls at holiday times are happening. We know also that we know that Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, still today is not said by Sephardim at Sukkot, and was added much later, by the way. So that's a whole different story. And we do know, though, that certain of those were read on Yontif. But again, I know now in a stronger way that obviously the context of my Mishnah is Shabbat and not Yom Tov. Problem is what? That if it's Shabbat and Yom Tov that come together, do I read from them? So there were those communities that went by the tradition that if it falls on a Shabbat, you don't read from the scrolls. Davka, we take them out today on Shabbat and we read them on the Shabbat, right? Very interesting history in and of itself as to why we actually read the scrolls from Ketuvim on Shabbat, perhaps to say, what? That these were elevating in holiness. Whereas before we didn't look at them on Shabbat, now we are reading them on Shabbat, and we're even adding, at a later date, Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, at Sukkot time. Because remember, we read Megillah of Esther, by the way, is the only one called Megillah, Scroll of Esther, at Purim. We read Eicha on Tisha B'Av. We read Shir Shirim at Pesach. Right? And then we read, we said, Ecclesiastes of Sukkot and Ruth on Shavuot. So we in essence do, and so Ketuvim gets its due, but here the Shita, the approach of this Braita, is to say, here's how to read the Mishnah. I have a different read of the Mishnah. The ones you read in are the Nevi'im. The ones you don't read are the Ketuvim. And therefore, where does that leave me? Af al pi sheketuvim bechol lashon, and even though they're written in any language, the lo nitnu likrot behen, this implies that they may not be read at all. V'katane matzilin, and still the Mishnah teaches, why? Save them! That you can save them. But to you, the Rav Huna, and this is an ultimate refutation of Rav Huna's view. So by looking at the language of the Mishnah in just a little bit of a different way, I get to a point where I completely refute Rav Huna's view, even in the Shita, where I don't read them. Rav Huna is going to come back and give a nice challenge, and we'll pick up with the argument there and look more deeply at, again, the issue of Targum as it's still going to be discussed within the Mishnaic and Talmudic discussion on the entire Mishnah here. And just to cap off the evening as we fold up the Gemara, I want to read you one passage. relating back to this overall issue again, it's page 6 in the packet. In addition to the dangers cited above, which were about the canon and canonicity, the rise of Christianity and with it a library of Christian writings, the New Testament and other works, threatened the authority of the scriptural writings of the Jews. The rabbis had to guard against certain mistranslations in the biblical text that reflected Christian influences. An example cited by Sir Frederick Kenyon, a noted Christian Bible scholar, from verse 10 of the Septuagint version of Psalm 96, which reads, "Tell it among the nations that the Lord reigneth from the wood," i.e. the cross, that is the cross. The last three words, "from the wood," had never been part of the original Hebrew. Another is, instead of "a young woman shall become pregnant and bear a son" in Isaiah 7, it said "a virgin shall." And though some Christian circles agreed to change it back to "young woman," there are those who demanded still that it remain virgin. So it's true that there were Greek ideas they were fighting against, but culture was strong. There were Christian ideas they were protecting against, but culture was strong. And at the heart of the discussion is, A, do we allow for translating? B, do we allow reading in it? Do we allow for it to be written down? Do we allow for it to be read? And what do we do with the fact that there are extant translations and they indicate to us that people are rereading what we would like to teach? So how do we create a culture? We create the culture of Shabbat. At the heart of the project is, we're in chapter 16 of Masechet Shabbat. Remember that the whole discussion is about what Jews do on Shabbat, either in an emergency or in the cultural milieu of Jewish existence, and that is to be in the Beit Midrash, to be in the study Shabbat afternoon, to return back for the public reading of Torah during Shabbat afternoon, also in this context, because the scroll comes into play again on the Sabbath day, and this is where we're centered, not just in the details of this discussion of translation and saving scrolls and reading from them, but in the production of the Sabbath culture that is at the heart of the rabbinic project in this Masechet. This is from this book called The Book of Books by Azriel Eisenberg.